Thank you, Ivan. As you can see, he covered a lot of material, and there's a lot more that we can talk about. So we'll just pause for 1 second while they change the videotape. Those of you who have questions, Alice has the microphone. If you would hold the microphone horizontal, it'll make it a little easier to be picked up. So, back, Ivan, if you want to field the questions yourself?
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe I should, because I can't really see everybody.
Great.
Okay, does anybody have a question? Yes, right here.
There was a program on PBS, I think it was maybe last night, I forget now. Anyway, it was a program on the Iraq War and about the beginnings of the Bush administration wish to invade Iraq, and apparently Wolfowitz was pushing for that very early on. And I'm wondering if you have any idea why he particularly wanted to invade Iraq, because they didn't talk about the reasons why.
Well, Paul Wolfowitz, for people who are unfamiliar, is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and he's really the architect of the Iraq strategy. And he's part of a group called what we call neoconservatives, and they're essentially big government conservatives. They're not like more fiscally conservative groups. They're for both big government domestically and overseas. And I think one of the main things that they want to do is they want to keep the U.S. as the number one country, the primacy doctrine. And also, I think they want to help Israel, and they think they're helping Israel. I'm not sure they are helping Israel, because if this all ends up in a civil war, they may not have helped Israel at all. But I think some of them, many of them, I think, are very pro-Israeli, and they thought they were helping Israel by doing this. I'm not saying that that was the only motivation for the invasion, but it certainly wasn't one of the three that they listed. The weapons of mass destruction. Now, everyone thought that, or many people thought that Iraq had both biological and chemical stockpiles of weapons. That no one thought that he had a nuclear weapon, but he was going towards that. That was the consensus. And I went from that basis before the war. I was against the war. But one thing that I thought was the most interesting in the lead-up to the war is that Bob Graham, who's the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, had the CIA declassify this a part of this report. And it reached a conclusion that even if Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, he'd be unlikely to use them or give them to terrorists unless he was backed into a corner. And I thought, you know, the president's own CIA is saying this, and yet it was a story that made the press for 2 days, and then everyone forgot about it. But so we have these official rationale. The second one was this link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam, which of course has never been proven, and the intelligence community was always skeptical about that as well. But the neoconservatives kept pushing this. And of course the third one is to democratize Iraq. But if you go, bring democracy and free markets, but if you go by the actions of the U.S. on the ground, both in terms of the weapons of mass destruction, when they got to Iraq, they didn't safeguard any of the facilities with weapons of mass destruction. So that would probably tell you that wasn't the primary purpose of it. And in addition, they behaved, if we're taking democracy and free markets to Iraq, we've canceled local elections, we've censored the press, and we've given contracts with no bid contracts. So there's no free market there. So up to this point, the United States hasn't really done a very good job in doing that. So, and I think also the State Department did a study just before the war that said if Iraq had an election, it would most probably elect an Islamic government that the United States wouldn't like. So, I mean, was that the real reason? You know, the stated reasons never seem to match up. And in addition, the real threats, if this was an imminent threat, the problem was, even if Saddam, in the worst case, had nuclear weapons, I always say the weapons of mass destruction issue, to me, really never made any sense at all, because even if Saddam, in the worst case, had nuclear weapons, he would have a few nuclear weapons. Well, North Korea's already got a few nuclear weapons, and Kim Jong-il is certainly more erratic and quirky, one might even say weird, than Saddam Hussein was. And yet we can negotiate with him, but we couldn't negotiate with Saddam. In addition, both Iran and North Korea were much farther along in long-range missiles that could hit the U.S. and nuclear programs. In fact, as I say, North Korea already had nuclear warheads. So, but even if Saddam had gotten these few nuclear warheads, I mean, the United States has thousands of nuclear warheads, and it deterred radical Maoist China when they got them in the 60s, deterred the Soviet Union. We didn't adopt a preventative strategy against the Soviet Union or against China, and we let Pakistan become a nuclear power. And Pakistan is probably the most dangerous country in the whole world because they have a fundamentalist population, and if they would overthrow Musharraf, they would have nuclear weapons. So we tend to, the threat things didn't really make any sense. Well, I think oil is always in the background. The two pillars of our Middle Eastern policy are oil and Israel. And I think Paul Wolfowitz even admitted on a couple of occasions that Iraq was different because of oil. In one case, he said, well, this was before the invasion, in justifying the invasion, he said, well, if we go into Iraq, we can get out of Saudi Arabia, which tells you something, that the U.S. government knows that when we're in Saudi Arabia that we're getting, that helped cause 9/11. And I think they wanted to get out of Saudi Arabia, so they had to have bases near the oil in the Persian Gulf, and Iraq was a substitute for Saudi. But, you know, we can only speculate as to why they went. But it didn't seem to me that the reasons that were given added up. Almost all of them, just one after the other, has fallen through. So anyway, yes, back here, this woman right here.
There are so many threads of what's going on in modern day society that would support all of what you've said this evening. And of course, it would be best if we could revert back to what General Washington said in his farewell address: be friends with all countries and trade with them, but be impartial. Now, one thing that I have, among other things that I've read about the Iraq situation, is that the United States government has imposed an income tax and social security numbers on the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. And this is kind of a rhetorical question if you don't know, but if they have in fact done that to supposedly spread democracy, who's collecting the money?
I don't know anything about that. I don't think they're probably making any money to tax, but do you have another right here?
I would like to get back to the concept of the imperial presidency. And I think that this started around World War II. And I wonder if events happen in the modern scene so rapidly that it's very, very difficult to wait for Congress to debate certain threats that occur here or there throughout the world. My example is Truman in Korea. I was with the 1st Marine Division that landed at Incheon in Korea. And by the time that we got there, most of Korea had already been conquered by the North Koreans. And although although China entered the war as well and trapped our division around the Chosin Reservoir, those soldiers were first-class fighting people, and they did a lot of damage, particularly to the Eighth Army. And so, on one hand, Truman did a great thing. He acted, and if we had waited for Congress to act, probably never would have gone into Korea. And I wonder if you would comment on the rapidity of events that happen in today's world that requires very fast action. And maybe the imperial presidency, although I'm against it, is a natural outcome of that.
Well, I think, first of all, we're talking about Korea and not an attack on the United States. And there was a lot of, shortly before the Korean War, there were documents that the JCS, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Pentagon they had planning guides, etc., which had basically written South Korea off as coming under Soviet influence since it was so, you know, close to the communist areas. And then when the North Korea attacked, everyone went, "Oh my God, we got to do something about this." So it's sort of because if you'll remember that we said that it was outside our defense perimeter. It's the same. We made the same mistake in Iraq. If we really wanted Iraq to stay out of Kuwait, we wouldn't have told Saddam, "Well, we don't get involved in inter-Arab territorial disputes." I mean, we made the same mistake in Korea in 1950 as we did in 1991 in the Gulf War. So we have to decide if these things are strategic and take preventative measures, or we have to, say that they're not and don't do anything. And I think, you know, the founders really knew that if the country was under attack, and I think the constitutional debates reflected this, the country was under attack or imminent attack was about to happen, the president did have the authority to do what was needed. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson did that very thing with the Barbary Pirates. They were attacking our ships, and Congress wasn't in session, so he sent the fleet. But after Congress got back into session, they gave him a resolution saying that he could employ this U.S. Naval power against not only the country that was attacking us, but all the Barbary states if they had to. So now with the advent of nuclear weapons, you have 30 minutes for a missile to fly from the Soviet Union or Russia to the United States. Now, the problem is we don't really have any defenses against missiles, so it's very hard to, you know, activate the defenses. These things that Bush is putting in the ground to show that he has missile defense, they simply don't work. So, not yet. I mean, maybe they never will, but anyway. So, nuclear weapons have made these things, technology does affect things, but certainly if the United States is under attack, I think, or imminent threat of attack, the president, under the Constitution, the original meaning, has ample, authority to go ahead and do something. But if you're launching an offensive war overseas, that requires, or at least according to the founders, a declaration of war. Now, we've moved away from that. Even in the Korean case, Truman went up to the Congress and he said, "Do you think I should ask for a declaration of war?" And the Congress told him no. Or at least the Congressional Committee Chairman. So there was plenty of time even then for the Congress to ratify. And certainly if emergency matters need to be taken, the president has the authority to do that. But the president doesn't have the authority to attack other countries without a declaration of war. And I think the founders would really bridle at any suggestion that that was the case. So I think certainly the nuclear weapons, I think, had a role in leading to the imperial presidency, but the question is, could we have avoided that? And I think we probably could. Even with nuclear weapons, we need to respect the Congress's, the founders' intent. And frankly, nuclear weapons, as bad as they are, they've cut down the number of cross-border wars. So the problem is, if they are used, you got a big problem then. But they have actually, nuclear weapons have restrained wars simply because they're so terrible. So technology is a two-edged sword in these things. But I still think the founders' conception of if the president needs to take emergency actions to defend the country, not to defend another country, then that's fine. But it can be the problem is it can be abused if you're talking about defending this and that overseas. Now, I just want to make one more point, and that is what you're talking about is a preemptive attack. Say you see our intelligence picks up that there is activities of a foreign power or something, or even a terrorist that's about ready to attack us. Certainly the president has a right to preemptive action to defend the country. There's no doubt about that. But the problem is Bush's doctrine is not really a preemptive doctrine. It's a preventative doctrine. He invaded Iraq to prevent a future threat down the road. And no one in the international community, I don't think, would criticize a country for taking preemptive action. If you think you're going to be attacked because you see, you pick up the fact that the enemy is making, you know, is taking ammunition to the front or whatever they're doing, it's foolish to sit around and let them do that. But the problem with the preventative war doctrine, which is really what the doctrine is, not preemptive war, and that is that it can be abused. And that's why the international community was so unnerved by Bush's action in Iraq, because he termed it a preemptive action, but there was no evidence that there was an imminent threat. Saddam didn't even have nuclear weapons, and nobody really thought he did. And he didn't have he didn't have the missiles to get him to the United States. So I think we need to be careful when we distinguish these things. And preventative war is much different than preemptive war. Okay, let's go over here.
So I think we're all pretty clear on what President Bush's continued policy in Iraq would be. What would John Kerry be able to do differently? If we pull out, it seems like we'll create a void where maybe an insurgent government will come in. What options would John Kerry really have to make a difference in that area?
Well, I think it's an illusion that there probably will be a different policy. I mean, my book is not aimed at criticizing the Bush administration. The book's title is not The Emperor Has No Clothes, it's The Empire Has No Clothes. And frankly, there's more continuity between presidents than there is difference. And frankly, there may be some hope that Kerry would do less of this because of his Vietnam experience, but of course, we saw that didn't seem to impair Bill Clinton from doing these types of things. So Kerry has the problem that he's a Democrat, and Democrats are perceived as wimpy, and so therefore he has the Clinton problem of appearing to be a wimp, although less from a personal standpoint since he went to Vietnam than Clinton did. Because of Clinton's draft dodging record, he let the military do anything they wanted. And so Kerry, I think, would be less constrained in a personal sense, but the Democrats often do these things because they want to appear tough. Like Kerry didn't oppose the war because he doesn't think he can win. And Kerry, and you know, there are differences between the two candidates, but hardly any difference on Iraq policy. Kerry thinks he's going to get more multilateral help, and you know, they're less annoyed with him because he wasn't president and he didn't tromp all over their egos. But the problem is, the war is very unpopular in those countries, and they don't want their people at risk in Iraq, and they don't want to pay the money that the U.S. is paying into a bottomless pit. And so the same set of factors is going to occur if Kerry takes office towards the end of January as it is now. And the security bureaucracies also, the inertia, the status quo, the mindset in Washington is we have to tough this out, and you know, that sort of thing. So I don't think it's going to get any better. The problem with Vietnam was it was sort of like an investor that bought a bad stock, and the investor can't bring him or herself to unload the stock and invest something else. You ride it to the bottom because you just can't. I can't believe that I made a big mistake. And in Vietnam, we stayed in because of U.S. credibility. And if we had gotten out, we would have lost credibility, but not as much as we lost in the end. So now my solution for Iraq is a partition, because I think, or some decentralized government, because I think that's the only thing that's going to save the country. The factions will probably break the country apart. In every case of where an authoritarian regime, a multi-ethnic authoritarian regime, has been, you have the authoritarian cap popped off of it, it's broken up. Now, sometimes it's peaceful, like Czechoslovakia and most of the Soviet Union, but sometimes it's not, like Yugoslavia. In this case, I think it's probably going to be more like Yugoslavia, but it's hard to say. Certainly, we've got a lot of groups with guns running around, and none of them trust each other, and all of them want control of the central government because they were all oppressed by the central government before, except for the Sunnis who did the oppressing, and now they're afraid of the payback. So what you need to do is create a decentralized central government that has very little power and have the areas govern themselves or completely partition the country. And that's not an ideal situation. There are drawbacks to that, but I think we're in such a hole that that's probably going to be the only way out of it. But I don't think Kerry will take that. I think he'll probably continue with exactly what Bush is doing. We have a history in the United States of where we criticize the other guy's foreign policy in the campaign, and then we adopt it. You know, they were from Truman to Eisenhower that happened, and remember Bush was going to run a more humble foreign policy. And he criticized Clinton for all these interventions, and you know, what did he do? He does the same thing, only and takes it to another level. Certainly, Bush's policy is, I think, more dangerous than Clinton. Clinton would intervene in places that were of little or no importance to the U.S. security, but the problem with this invasion is that it has increased the threat to the homeland by stirring up the Islamic world, and so. I don't know what Kerry will do, and I'm not sure that he's of the mindset to do anything different. I mean, it does give him a fresh start. If he were elected, he could say, if he were smart, he would look at the documents for a couple of days and go, boy, this is worse than they were telling us. We're getting out of here. Because I think, you know, he's going to be in trouble if it's going to be another LBJ Nixon situation where we change administrations, but it's the same problem. Let's go right here.
Hi, Evan. Hi. It's okay. Hi, I'm Terry Easton. I'd like to ask your thoughts about what I see as an imminent problem in the future, rather than Iraq, which I think will fade off the radar screens after the election, no matter who wins. And that is the issue of the 4,000-pound gorilla in that region, a true old 4,000-year-old historical empire, Persia. Iran, a country creating stands, Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., as a threat potentially to not only this country and our quote empire, but also to the world. And here we have a regime which, within probably 6 months, the intelligence estimates, will have thermonuclear weapons, and we're looking at a proto-Nazi, essentially a fascist regime. Neil Ferguson argues that there are only three, empires in the world today. We have the Western Empire, us. We have the Eastern Empire, the Chinese, which is not really an expansionist empire historically. And we have the Tweedledees of the European Union, who are not really effective. So the only empire that can address this issue defaults to the United States. What, if anything, should we do about that?
Well, I think, you know, everyone was always so alarmed about Iraq, but Iran is a small country GDP-wise, and frankly, population-wise, compared to, it's bigger than Iraq, certainly, and it's a much tougher nut to crack for an invasion because the terrain, the area is bigger than Iraq, and the terrain is more mountainous, and the people will, if you think the Iraqis are fighting, the Iranians have a deep-seated disdain for the U.S. So I'm not sure what you're going to do about it. I got a briefing from the Pentagon that listed 12 nuclear programs, and these are not British or French or friendly nuclear programs, if you want to call them friendly, but these are threat nuclear programs. We have 12 nuclear programs. We have 13 biological weapons program, countries with biological weapons, 16 with chemical weapons, and 26 with ballistic missiles. So if we're going to run this type of preventative policy, it's simply unsustainable. We can't even do it in one country. So I think we're probably going to have to live with more countries getting nuclear weapons. I mean, we've certainly, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. They're Islamic, and they could face a fundamentalist revolution, especially if Musharraf gets too tied to the U.S. That has inflamed the fundamentalists there. So we're probably going to face the fact, have to face the fact that some countries that we really don't like have nuclear weapons. We faced that before, the Soviet Union, as I say, radical Maoist China. And so I agree with your characterization that the Iranian government is not very good. But when we raise the term fascist, we always go back to Hitler. Hitler had a lot more economic power and was a much bigger threat than Iran is, or Iraq. But every threat we had Milosevic was Hitler. We had Saddam was Hitler. Everybody's compared to Hitler. But these are very small countries economically, and their militaries aren't very big. And if they do get nuclear weapons, I'm not sure there's much we can do about it, because they've gotten smart since the Osirik incident in 1981, where the Israelis took out the Iraqi reactor. They bury the facilities. They hide them. They put them in urban areas, so we have to kill a lot of civilians if we want to bomb them. And a lot of times we can't really find them. In Operation Desert Fox in 1998, Clinton said we were going to take out their weapons of mass destruction. Well, then the Pentagon got kind of alarmed by that, because they were going to be held to that, so they leaked to the press. Well, we can't really do that. So then Clinton said, well, we're going to undermine their ability to make weapons of mass destruction. And then the Pentagon says, well, more leaks from the Pentagon. And the Pentagon came out and said, so then they had quotes from officers that says, we don't really know where these things are. And so, of course, there weren't any, apparently. So maybe that's why. But no, I mean, they had no idea where they were at the time, so they could hit them with strikes. So it's a tough problem. But I think the fact that we have thousands of warheads and can incinerate the country with just a few of them deters a lot of countries from doing things that they wouldn't normally do. They have a home address. The people that you really have to watch out for are the people that don't have a home address that you can incinerate, and that is the terrorists. Yeah. I think we only have time for one more question. This woman in the back here.
Am I hearing you? You mentioned that in our Middle East policy, oil and Israel are two of the factors. And I wonder if you could talk about the reasons behind the United States' stance on Israel.
Well, I feel that Israel is primarily a domestic issue here at home. It's not a strategic issue. I don't even believe we need to defend oil because of the economics of oil. But if you accept the fact that we need to defend oil, then being a friend of Israel is not a good idea, because the Arabs have the oil. It's very elementary. But I mean, this is an example, and it's not the only example of pressure groups driving U.S. policy. I mean, NATO expansion Bill Clinton was opposed to NATO. Well, I won't say he was opposed to it. He was lukewarm about NATO expansion until he figured out that 5 to 10% of the voters in key Northeast Midwestern states that the Democrats needed to win in 1994 and 1996 were ethnic Poles, ethnic Hungarians, and ethnic Czechs. So they drove the policy. And he said, oh, well, why not? Well, let's expand NATO, because these people wanted it. The same is true with the pressure groups on Israel in this country. But you could make a halfway make an argument that Israel was a strategic ally and outpost during the Cold War. But, I mean, you could have other allies in that region. It wouldn't necessarily have to be Israel. Now, Israel is the most westernized of the country, and it's the most democratic. But is it a strategic necessity? The other thing is, people imply that Israel will fall if the United States doesn't provide massive amounts of aid. But that's not historically true. In fact, we only started aiding Israel massively in 1968. Well, Israel's biggest military victories happened before that, and I would argue that the 1973 war, the Israelis won it barely militarily, and they lost it politically, and they lost the war in early 80s in Lebanon. So if we're helping them, we're not doing a great, they're not doing any better militarily. I mean, they have an excellent military, and they can defend themselves, plus they have probably 200 nuclear weapons. So the same applies to us applies to them. If you have a nuclear arsenal and nobody else has one in that region, your security, plus their largest enemy, Egypt, went away. Egypt is the most dangerous state to Israel simply because of Egypt's population is much greater than the other Arab countries. And Jordan is at peace, Egypt is at peace, and Syria didn't modernize its military after its Soviet benefactor went away. So Israel is really, there are no existential threats to Israel. You have this intifada, which is certainly, you don't want your citizens to be blown up on buses and everything, but it's Israel's not going away tomorrow. And even if we cut all the aid off to Israel, Israel would survive and probably prosper, because this aid acts, their economy is dependent on this aid, and it's a crutch. And they, if they took that away, the Israeli economy would probably do a lot better. So I don't think it's a strategic necessity to support Israel with $3 billion in aid every year. And frankly, it does contribute to the terrorism problem that we face. It's not the only reason, because frankly, bin Laden has added this as he went along in his writings. His main gripe is with our Soviet presence in the holy lands of the Persian Gulf. But Israel is a factor in blowback terrorism as well. So I think that's all the time we have. So I'd like to thank everybody for coming.
I want to thank Ivan for his work. Again, those of you who don't have a copy of his book, there are copies upstairs, and he'd be delighted to autograph copies for you. This debate is not going away. It's simply intensifying, and we're delighted to have Ivan involved and have you here to make tonight so successful. So thank you, and we look forward to seeing you at our next event. Good night.